Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that prehistoric women were ridiculously strong. There's a certain stereotype of prehistoric men and women. Picture the brutish Stone Age man returning from a hunt and clunking the submissive woman over the head and dragging her home. This, of course, is pure mythology. The fact is, we know very little about the social lives of early humans, and yet this distorted view of ancient men and women does stubbornly persist, even in science. There was one study, for example, that examined prehistoric behavior by comparing the skeletons of women directly to the skeletons of men. Because the male bones were bulkier, the study suggested that women weren't doing as much physical activity. But that's not a fair comparison. Men's bones tend to bulk up more noticeably in response to strain. So comparing men's bones to women's is a classic apples to oranges setup, which only perpetuates this underestimation of the physical labor women actually did during ancient times. But a new study published in the journal Science Advances sets the record straight. This time around, researchers compared the skeletons of prehistoric women, we're talking from the Neolithic era and up, to contemporary women, but not just your average Jane, athletes, too. Researchers took CT scans of a variety of modern women, the sedentary and the athletic. The athletes were college rowers, endurance runners, and soccer players. When comparing those contemporary bones to the ancient ones, researchers found that the leg bones of the Neolithic women were about as strong as the rowers. But what's interesting is that their arms were significantly stronger, about 11 to 16%. When compared to the sedentary women, the difference was staggering. The ancient lady arms were 30% stronger. Due to this new extensive evaluation of the bones, researchers were also able to guess what kind of physical activity these ancient women likely endured. Because of the particular bone shape and rigidity, our Neolithic ancestors likely tilled soil, harvested crops, and ground grain to make flour for as much as 5 hours a day, which gave them their exceptional strength. Of course, things like diet and age would also factor into bone density and therefore strength, but researchers believe the evidence is pretty clear. Prehistoric women were not only way stronger than we thought, but were also likely integral in the development of agriculture across Europe. Girl power, man, it's in our bones. This week I learned the delightfully weird way that turtles survive the winter. Turtles, with their flippers and streamlined bodies, are built for water. Sea turtles only leave the ocean to lay eggs in the sand, and freshwater turtles only step out of their ponds and lakes to bask in the sun. But during the frigid winter months, well, things get a little tricky underwater. You see, unlike frogs, turtles don't hibernate, at least not completely. Their metabolism slows way, way down. Turtles are ectotherms, meaning their body temperature matches the environment it's in. So the colder a turtle gets, the slower its metabolism. And a slower metabolism means lower energy and, more importantly, lower oxygen demands. While pond and lake water will actually stay relatively stable during the winter, it takes a lot for water to dip below freezing completely, constantly, the ice that tends to layer at the top does get in the way for our dear turtles. When it ices, turtles, for one, can't surface for air. But the other problem is that breathing already expends a lot of a turtle's energy when during the winter it can't use up very much of it. Turtles, you see, don't have ribs. Their shell actually evolved from ribs and vertebrae that flattened out and fused together, Without ribs, the turtle's lungs can't expand the way ours do. Instead, turtles have these muscles that pull the body outwards toward the opening of the shell to allow it to inhale, and then it uses other muscles to sort of squish the turtle's guts against its lungs to make it exhale. This takes up a lot of energy. When trapped underwater during the winter for months at a time, this can be a very stressful situation. Oxygen, as I already mentioned, is scarce, and turtles have to reserve the energy they have. So some turtles deal with this troubled oxygen situation by switching some bodily functions, like fat burning, to go without oxygen during the winter. The other winterized survival tactic is butt breathing. You see, turtles can take in what oxygen the water has. They do this by moving the oxygen across parts of the body that have blood vessels. And the part of the body that has a nice high level of blood vessels is in the rear. Now, to get a little technical here, a turtle's hind isn't an anus, it's a cloaca. Whereas the anus is just a release for solid waste, the cloaca excretes waste, urine, and eggs. So next to the cloaca are sacs called bursa, and these easily expand. The walls of these sacs are lined with those very helpful blood vessels. So oxygen enters the sacs, diffuses through the blood vessels, and then the sacs deflate, kind of like a mini lung. This whole process takes up enormously less energy for wintering turtles that already have very little to spare. In the spring, the turtle can emerge from the cold waters, find a patch of sun to warm itself, fire up its metabolism once again, and get its little body back into springtime shape. This week, I learned that cuddling newborn babies can affect them on a molecular level. Researchers out of the University of British Columbia in Canada corralled parents of 94 newborns for this study. The parents were charged with keeping a diary of their touching and cuddling habits, as well as the behavior of their babies, when they slept, when and how much they cried, etc. 4.5 years later, researchers took DNA swabs of the kids. Researchers analyzed something called DNA methylation, which are basically slight changes within parts of chromosomes that affect how genes function. What researchers found were distinct differences between the DNA methylation in high-contact children and in low-contact children. Those differences appeared within genes related to the immune system and the metabolic system. Researchers also noticed another telling marker, the biological aging of blood and tissue. In the low-contact kids, this marker was lower than expected. And in previous studies, gaps between this biological aging and a child's actual age have been linked to health problems. What we have here is clear evidence of molecular differences between kids who are cuddled and those who are cuddled less. How these differences actually play out in a child's health remains to be seen. But it is well accepted that touch is incredibly important for development. Studies have found this in humans, worms, and even rat pups. And so far, this is the first study to look at how much touch might be changing a baby's genetics. This week I learned that just thinking you don't exercise enough could lead to an early death. Being active is one of the key ingredients to a healthy lifestyle, so much so that being inactive is the fourth leading risk factor for death. According to the World Health Organization, inactivity causes an estimated 3.2 million deaths around the world each year. But new research suggests how we perceive our activity may be just as important as the activity itself. There's an earlier experiment that's actually pretty enlightening. Researchers met with hotel room attendants and gave them a 20-minute talk about health. They told them that all the activity these women did on the job, the walking, the cleaning, the being on their feet, met the daily recommendations for exercise. Researchers also shared the health benefits of living such an active lifestyle. And what's amazing is that just being told this information improved the attendants' health after the fact. When the researchers checked back in, the attendants had lower blood pressure. They also lost some weight and body fat. Researchers from Stanford University examined data culled from more than 60,000 Americans who had taken exercise surveys. The data included detailed information about how much physical activity the people thought they had undertaken and how much activity they had actually completed. Researchers then cross-checked the survey data against the National Death Index records 21 years after the exercise surveys had been completed. And researchers found overwhelmingly that a person's perceptions about how much exercise they got were strongly related to their longevity. People who considered themselves less active than others, even when that perception was false, were up to 71% more likely to die in the follow-up period than those who considered themselves more active. And this is even after accounting for things like actual levels of activity and other mortality determinants like smoking and obesity. Kind of alarming, right? Well, there may be a few explanations. So first is that perceptions affect motivation. So like in that room attendant study, just knowing your lifestyle is a healthy one can motivate a person to make other healthy changes in her life. On the other side of things, studies have shown that if you think you're a lazy lump, well, then you're much less likely to exercise down the road. The other explanation has to do with the placebo and its sinister sister, the nocebo effect. Studies have found that people who take placebos, even when they're told the medicine isn't real, can have positive side effects nonetheless. So in this study, not realizing you're already getting the good exercise you need is like being in the dark about consuming the good medicine, whether it's real or not. So despite being active, these folks were missing out on the full physiological benefits of exercise. And then on the other end of the spectrum, the nocebo can have a negative effect on a person's health. So if it's understood that being inactive can have life-threatening consequences, well, then just believing that you're not meeting those requirements of a healthy lifestyle can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. For better or worse, the mind is a powerful influencer. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can check out theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainer series. And if you've come across any scientific tidbits, fascinating studies, or historical revelations that you'd like to share, you can email me. You can reach me at podcasts@theweek.com. And until next week, I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.